are the odds, if left in office, that he will continue trying to cheat? I will tell you, 100%. Not 5, not 10, or even 50, but 100%. If you have found him guilty and you do not remove him from office, he will continue trying to cheat in the election until he succeeds.
Congressman Adam Schiff today asking the Senate to convict President Donald Trump of abuse of office and obstruction of Congress. Both the House impeachment managers and Trump's defense team gave their closing arguments as the impeachment trial ends. Trump's team reiterated their claims that he did nothing wrong and that senators should leave the issue up to the voters. Here is White House counsel Pat Cipollone.
It does not even allege a violation of law. It is passed in an election year, and we're sitting here on the day that election season begins in Iowa. It is wrong. There is only one answer to that, and the answer is to reject those articles of impeachment, to have confidence in the American people.
Well, the president is all but guaranteed to be acquitted when senators vote on Wednesday. Meanwhile, in a court filing late Friday, the Trump administration acknowledged that it has 24 emails that reveal his thinking on why he withheld aid from Ukraine. And that came hours after Senate lawmakers voted against subpoenaing new witnesses and documents. Jessica Levinson is here to talk about all this. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Hi.
Happy Monday.
Wow. Okay. What about these emails? We keep hearing about emails. So these are about 24 emails that we didn't know existed before?
Well, the people who wrote and received them certainly knew they existed. So they were written by officials at the Office of Management and Budget and by officials at the Department of Defense, essentially in part about why the aid to the Ukraine was being withheld. And so obviously this goes to the heart of the impeachment inquiry. And the reason we're finding out about it at all is that the Center for Public Integrity sued the Department of Justice and said, we have a FOIA request. We want to obtain these emails. The FOIA request was denied. And they said, no, we really are entitled to these emails. Then the emails were provided, but they were heavily redacted. Mm. Round two of the litigation, let's fight over whether or not the redactions are appropriate. That's what brings us to Friday night, where the Department of Justice said, no, I'm really sorry. We have to redact those because it actually goes to President Trump's frame of mind and thinking as to why he withheld aid to the Ukraine.
Which is the very heart of the impeachment battle.
But also based on how the Department of Justice lawyers framed it, could fall within presidential or executive privilege. So presidents are entitled to keep certain things private if it goes to their deliberations, their deliberative process, their thinking leading up to a decision. What's the other reason that presidents are entitled to keep certain things private? For instance, if national security is at issue, there's basically two buckets. What the Department of Justice said in this filing is, we're in bucket number one, Judge. We don't have to give you these unredacted emails. But in explaining why the redactions had to stay in place, they're essentially saying, oh, yes, there's a lot of writing about why President Trump may have withheld these funds from the Ukrainian government.
So is that the final word on this, or will they keep fighting over whether or not these can be redacted?
I feel pretty comfortable saying there really is not going to be a final word on most of this. So we don't know what the judge is going to say with respect to whether or not the redactions are private. We don't. Of course, this could also be appealed. I mean, is it the final word in this particular case? No, not yet. This case is still ongoing. Does it make any difference for the impeachment trial? I think the answer to that is no, because, again, the difference between a courtroom and political theater.
Mm. And plus they're voting on Wednesday. So they won't be unredacted by then.
No, they will not.
Okay. Let's turn to another major story that's happening during that has really happened. And we missed it because we were covering the impeachment seemingly 24/7. And about a week ago, the Trump administration threatened to withhold federal money from California if it did not drop a requirement that private health insurance plans must cover abortion services. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So basically, there's something on the federal level called the Weldon Amendment, and it says that states and local governments, you can't discriminate against healthcare providers that do not provide for abortions. And the argument that the federal government's making is California, by saying that private insurers have to provide coverage for abortions, we're discriminating against providers who don't provide for abortions. And so what the Department of Health and Human Services had said is, California, we just want to let you know, and also they didn't say it, but let all the other states, I think there are about 10 other states, know that we might use this nuclear option of withholding federal funds if you don't change your law and allow for private insurers to not cover elected abortions.
And didn't this come up under the Obama administration, and it was an exactly opposite argument that the administration was making?
Yes. So this issue did come up during the Obama administration. There was a complaint that was filed by two Catholic universities. I work for one of them. And the Obama administration looked at California's rule. They looked at the Weldon Amendment. And it sounds a little detailed, but they basically said that the people who were complaining weren't the right people to complain, that the health insurers didn't have standing. They looked at the Weldon Amendment and they said, we're pretty comfortable that this is being followed. This is why there's this huge area of law called administrative law. We don't talk about it a lot, but can one administration to the next change an interpretation? Yes. So there's something that, you know, we should be talking more about, and we likely will, which is called the administrative state, and how you can have the Trump administration come in, look at very similar regulations or identical regulations and say, we see it in a different way, which is not even covering all the things that administrations can do via regulations, adding new regulations, taking regulations away.
And the old executive privilege.
Yes.
Once again.
Our good friend.
Okay. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, separating the facts from the hysteria over the coronavirus. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The coronavirus continues to spread, and with it, fear. Now there's a travel ban on people traveling from China to the United States, unless you are an American citizen or an immediate family member of a citizen. Americans returning from Wuhan province are under quarantine for 2 weeks, even if they're not sick. But it appears the fear is outpacing the reality. Nearly 400 people have died in China, more than died in the SARS outbreak. But coronavirus so far has just a 2% fatality rate. Compare that to 9.5% for SARS. And just this season, the regular flu has killed around 10,000 people. Here to talk about all of this is Dr. Syra Madad. She's a special pathogens expert who works for New York City. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Okay, so there are roughly about a dozen confirmed cases here in the United States, half in California. Do you expect that number to rise dramatically?
So there's no indication currently or no data to support how widespread it can become in the United States. But I think there are obviously certain aspects where you have there hasn't been sustained person-to-person transmission. So while we've had a first, you know, a couple of cases of secondary transmission through close contact, there hasn't been actual transmission in the community, which is a great sign. So just in terms of how big this may get, we're not exactly sure, but currently the risk to the general American public is low.
And so do you think quarantining is a good idea?
So it's, you know, with these public health measures, these draconian type measures, it's very hard to tell from a domestic and even international standpoint if they are going to have any benefit. But just from a basic infection control standpoint, any way we can limit folks, you know, coming together in certain settings, you know, helps to prevent the spread of the infectious disease, here in this case, the novel coronavirus. However, you know, there are a number of other issues and factors at play, you know, given with these types of restrictions. You know, where there's a will, there's a way. So someone may find a way to actually, you know, get out of isolation or quarantine, if you will. And if they're infected, spreading that disease elsewhere, and then it gets harder for public health to be able to track where this individual is going. So a number of other factors that come into play. But whether this is going to work or not, only time will tell.
Right. And closing the border, is that a good idea?
We've seen historically when things like this have happened, these types of measures, they have not proven to be successful. You know, each outbreak is very different and the makeup of each outbreak is different. So we'll see.
What is a successful way to combat an outbreak like this?
One of the biggest ways is really the risk communication. So letting the public know the facts and then what they can do to prevent the spread of this type of disease. And I think we are currently battling two types of outbreaks. One, the actual coronavirus outbreak happening at the global scale. And the next is this contagion of misinformation. A lot of folks, you know, coming out of the woodworks stating that they know what the coronavirus is, giving clinical or just, you know, advice to folks that is now not based on science. Folks are thinking, you know, this is a very severe disease. We don't have the reliable data yet. So there, we are trying to face not just obviously the actual disease itself, but this contagion of misinformation that is perpetuating and causing even more fear and anxiety.
So what are some of the things you're seeing that's just, as you say, misinformation?
So I think the biggest is the wearing masks. So if you go to your local retail pharmacy, you know, across, you know, the nation, a number of these commercial pharmacies are reporting a shortage of just surgical masks. And what we know based on the data that we have available is we wear masks if you are infected with an infectious disease. For example, if you have seasonal flu, you put the mask on to prevent the spread of the disease to others, not the other way around. So if you're wearing a mask and you're a healthy individual, you know, folks think that they have a sense of protection against, for example, the coronavirus. That is not the case. Coronaviruses are very small. They're in microns in size. You can't see them with the naked eye. And you need a respiratory filtering piece in the mask to be able to filter out these airborne particles. A surgical or normal mask will not do that. A healthcare worker wears their specialized N95 mask to be able to filter out these particles. So folks get this, you know, false sense of security that if I wear a mask, I'm okay. And then they don't follow the other basic infection control measures that do work, like washing your hands, staying away from those that are sick, thinking they can go out in public and interact with sick folks, for example, and just wear a mask. And that is not the case.
Is that true with other infectious diseases like the regular flu, that the mask doesn't help prevent it?
That's right. So, you know, you would wear a mask again in the healthcare setting. You know, when we have a patient that presents and they have fever, cough, rash, or other respiratory signs and symptoms, we offer a mask to make sure that they don't spread whatever disease they're coming in with to others around them, visitors, staff, things like that. You know, it helps contain it or source control. And so, you know, folks that are wearing a mask that are healthy, a very limited protection that it could provide.
Does it even help prevent the spread? Because as you say, if it's so small, microns, as you say, can't it go through the mask if you sneeze and you're wearing a mask and you're sick?
So it's all about the seal. So if you don't have a good seal around your face, then certainly, obviously, you're able to spread the disease. But there's other ways of transmission of the novel coronavirus that we know about. So not just obviously coughing and sneezing, but close contact with somebody that's sick or through fomites. For example, you know, you have droplets that fall on the, you know, on the floor, the doorknob, and then someone comes and then they touch it shortly after, and then they touch their mucous membrane. So there's different ways of actually transmitting this type of novel coronavirus. And so, you know, wearing a mask, obviously, there is some benefits to it. For example, it prevents you from actually touching your mucous membranes because you have a barrier there. But in terms of actually filtering out the coronavirus from the air, it does not do that. So I just want to make sure people don't have this false sense of security. It's always good to do basic infection control preventions. These are things that have been proven to be effective. So again, washing your hands with soap for at least 20 seconds, staying away from those that are sick, you know, other types of measures that you can take that you normally take during seasonal flu time as it is.
Mm. Would you say that right now the preventative measures and the the amount of attention that this is receiving is out of proportion with the actual danger?
That's correct. There are certain other, viruses or diseases out there that are much more common, that are much more likely to actually have an effect on you, depending on where you are. So for right now, if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, it is still peak flu time. The general population, less than half actually get vaccinated with the seasonal flu. And yet, as you've mentioned, over 10,000 deaths have been reported from seasonal flu just in the United States. Over, 18 to 20 million Americans have already become sick with seasonal flu. So it's much more likely you would get seasonal flu than the novel coronavirus. Again, so putting things into context, things that, can affect you on a daily basis versus things that have a very low probability or likelihood.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Syra Madad. She's a special pathogens expert who works in New York City. Well, here in California, there are 6 confirmed cases of coronavirus. 2 California military bases have been selected as possible quarantine sites for overseas travelers. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention ordered a quarantine for hundreds of people from Wuhan evacuated to a base in Riverside County last week. There's also a lot of misinformation, as we discussed, in the form of hoaxes and fake news spreading across the internet. We're going to talk about all this now with Alex Wigglesworth. She covers the coronavirus right now and the outbreak and the reaction for the LA Times. Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Great, thanks. Okay, so over the weekend, the Defense Department says it could house 1,000 people who may need to be quarantined when they arrive in the U.S. What does that mean? What does that look like?
Sure. So the Defense Department announced that it's freed up 1,000 beds at 4 military bases. 2 of the 4 are in California. They're Travis Air Force Base in Solano County and the Marine Corps Air Station Miramar in San Diego County. So officials say that the Defense Department will be responsible only for housing any possible evacuees. They're going to be Americans who are returning from overseas travel in China and are subject to quarantine. And Health and Human Services personnel will be responsible for sort of handling monitoring and any medical treatment that may be needed. And congressional leaders actually announced on Sunday that for the first wave of people fleeing the outbreak in China will fly into the Marine Corps Air Station in Miramar this week. And they're expected to be quarantined for 14 days, which is believed to be the virus's incubation period.
And this is the first time there's been a quarantine at this level in like 50 years, right, at least?
Yes. So there's currently 195 people who are now being quarantined at March Air Reserve Base in Riverside County. And those were people who were evacuated from the U.S. Embassy in Wuhan, which is believed to be the epicenter of the outbreak. They flew there last week. Then on Friday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention ordered that they be quarantined for 14 days from when the plane left China. And that was the CDC's first mandatory quarantine in more than 50 years.
And we don't know whether or not those 195 people have the virus.
No, no one of those 195 people has been confirmed to be ill. They're just being monitored and kept on the base for the duration of the virus incubation period.
Okay. And so what about the 6 confirmed cases so far here in California? What do we know about those?
Sure. So one of them is in L.A. County, one's in Orange County, and then up north, 2 are in San Benito County and 2 in Santa Clara County. And all of those people had recently traveled to China, except for one of the patients in San Benito County. Her husband is believed to have transmitted coronavirus to her after he returned from traveling in China. And that was actually only the second case of human-to-human transmission recorded in the United States. But all those patients are reported to be in good condition. Some of them are hospitalized. Some are just being monitored at home. And officials say that they're keeping a close eye on both them and anyone that they may have been in contact with.
Well, meanwhile, as we discussed in the earlier segment, there's a lot of panic out there. A lot of people are freaking out, and you can see that on the web. Yeah. What have you seen?
I'm sure there, especially locally, there's been a lot of rumors and they're really creating panic. And many of them have involved college campuses. There's been rumors circulating that members of certain college communities, whether it's students or staffers, have contracted the virus. That happened at UC Irvine, Irvine Valley College, USC. Now, none of that was true. And in the case of USC, the school actually had to issue a campus-wide emergency alert, letting people know that there were no confirmed cases of coronavirus. And that was last Monday. the building manager of an off-campus apartment complex had sent out an email saying that a tenant had contracted the virus, and it really sent people into a panic. But it turned out not to be true. Then there have been other instances that appear to be, you know, not just rumors, but deliberate hoaxes. In at least two of the cases, there were communications that were made to look like news articles stating that students at different high schools had contracted the coronavirus. One was in Orange County and one in Santa Ana. And then there was also something that appeared to be a letter from the Department of Public Health saying that there had been sort of a widespread outbreak in the city of Carson. And in that case, the LA County Sheriff's Department is actually actively investigating the hoax as a criminal matter. And the FBI is also involved. There are possible federal implications. And many of those false reports were spread through social media. People sort of shared things before they had confirmed it was true. Mm-hmm. And experts say, you know, there's definitely an urgency when it comes to passing on information that's related to health. It may sort of lend itself to the spread of these kinds of rumors. But officials say that's why it's so important to check with, you know, your local public health department and your own personal health care provider before you're passing on that kind of information to avoid contributing to the spread of fear and false reports.
Yeah, it's kind of like an information virus.
Yes.
So I guess it could be criminal because it's like yelling fire in a crowded theater, right? It could cause panic and a lot of real harm.
Sure. And then also, you know, when you're making something look like an official communication, you're signing government officials' names on it.
That's
there
fraud.
Are also, you know, some sort of fraud and forgery implications.
Right, right. And but then, you know, in the Chinese American community here in Los Angeles, it was a big weekend, right? There was a Lunar New Year and all these activities were planned. Some were postponed because of the fear, right?
Sure. Alhambra postponed indefinitely its Lunar New Year celebration, which that had been scheduled for this weekend. It wasn't necessarily because of the risk of coronavirus. Officials really cited fears over the virus and said they believed that it would just affect the turnout, that the turnout would be too low. But then in LA's Chinatown, the Lunar New Year Festival and their Golden Dragon Parade, that took place this weekend as scheduled, and the turnout appears to be good. You know, the mayor was there, and no problems were reported.
All right, Alex, thank you so much.
Sure, thanks so much.
That's Alex Wigglesworth, reporter at the LA Times. Coming up, they fell in love as teenagers in Vietnam. Then he moved here to America, to Southern California. She followed 6 years later.
They got off the plane and they did not, you know, run across the airport into each other's arms. They kind of looked at each other and were like, you? Like, oh, I don't know about that. Maybe, eh.
Decades later, they fell in love again on the dance floor. Their story told in the Oscar-nominated short Walk, Run, Cha-Cha. That story next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and now a story of two people separated by war, reunited here in the U.S., and finding each other through dance.
We dance like the, what they call slow dance, just like two of us, like close.
I feel he's shaking. I am too.
I vividly remember he can dance. I start becoming his girlfriend because we in love so much, so in love.
Millie and Paul Gao met in Vietnam nearly 50 years ago. They fell in love. But soon the war broke out and they were separated. And when they finally reunited 6 years later, right here in Southern California, they started taking cha-cha lessons in order to reconnect. Their story is told in the Oscar-nominated documentary short Walk, Run, Cha-Cha. It's from the New York Times and directed by Laura Nix. And she joins me now. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, how did you first meet them?
I stumbled upon their dance studio by accident. It's called Lai Lai, and it's in Alhambra. And I walked in, and there was about 50 Asian people dancing the tango in the middle of the day. And I thought, what is this beautiful world? And I started taking dance classes there to find out. And I spent a year at the studio taking dance classes to meet people to answer that question. And what I discovered was that it was it's a studio that is mostly Eastern European teachers, professional ballroom teachers, who are teaching standard and Latin dance to people from the Chinese community in suburban LA. And I thought, this is my favorite version of America, and I've got to make a film about this place. So I stuck around.
It also sounds very LA, just this mixing of cultures and immigrant stories, and so many. Each person probably has an incredible story of arriving here.
Yes, it's a room of unbelievable stories, and also visually, it was so beautiful to see mostly middle-aged and senior people dedicating themselves to ballroom dancing. So seriously and so passionately. And the contrast between the very young professional ballroom dancers with perfect bodies up against, you know, older folks learning how to dance was just so beautiful. And then it became this question for me that really drove the whole film, which is, why is everybody dancing so seriously? And that's when I met Paul and Millie, because they were in my class and we became friends. And eventually I popped the question, the documentary question, would you let me film you?
And what was it about them that you thought, okay, well, they're the ones out of all of these dancers here, they're the ones who are going to make a good story?
Paul and Millie are really open people. They're very friendly. And that's really important when you're trying to make a documentary film, is that you need people who are game to kind of let you hang around a lot. And I was also really intrigued by the fact that they work full time. They both have full time jobs. And the fact that they're dancing 4 to 5 nights a week, plus going in for practices on weekends and doing, you know, competitions and recitals on weekends in addition to all their dance training and their full-time jobs, just blew my mind. And, you know, they started doing this when they were in their early 60s. Mm. And not everybody there has that level of commitment, but they really did. And that was very fascinating to me. And I wanted to get to the bottom of what was driving that.
So what is driving that? Why are they so serious about it?
You know, I think they left, they met, first of all, when they were really young. I think she was 19 and he was 20. And they had this whirlwind romance of 6 months. They used to go on dates where they strolled in the Saigon Zoo. And they fell in love. And it lasted 6 months. And then he had the opportunity to flee Vietnam. And at that time, it was very, very difficult to get out. And it was, I think he left in 77, 78. And he wasn't able to bring her.
And so this is after the war is over.
It wasn't over, really. I mean, because for them, it was after we left. It was after the Americans left. But the conflict was still going on. And Viet Cong was coming over and had it basically taken over Da Nang, where he is from. And at that point, they'd also taken Saigon. And Paul is from Da Nang, but he was going to school in Saigon, and that's how he met Millie. They used to go to dance parties together, and that was when they first met, because they met by dancing, actually, when they were super young. And anyways, his family said, it's time to go, we have to go. And he started to plan leaving, and at that point, you couldn't tell people if you were planning on going, because it was very dangerous to try and get out. But when there finally was a plan to go, he had to do it, and he knew he had to leave her behind. So even though he was in love with her, he couldn't take her with him, and even though he wanted to, and so he had to go.
And that broke their hearts.
I think it was just devastating for both of them, because they were so connected and they had just started this romance and they were so full of hope. But Paul is the oldest son of his family, and he needed to take care of his parents and his siblings and make sure that they could get on the boat and get out. And that was his primary responsibility instead of a girlfriend that he had just met. So after he left, they spent 6 years separated, and then they were in a lot of limbo, not knowing what would happen next and if they would ever see each other again. But Paul started the process of trying to bring Millie into the country. And they weren't married, so he wasn't able to do it that way. So he went through, it's a very long, complicated story that I won't get into right now, but he did eventually secure a visa for her, and she was able to finally leave Vietnam. 6 years later, she got on a plane for the first time, and she flew to Los Angeles, California.
To be with him? And she hadn't seen him in 6 years?
And she hadn't seen him in 6 years.
So it could have not worked out.
It could not have worked out. And there's a moment in the film when she talks about that. They got off the plane and they did not you know, run across the airport into each other's arms, they kind of looked at each other and were like, you? Like, oh, I don't know about that. Maybe, eh. And they were super uncomfortable and they weren't sure if it was going to work. And then they decided that they would, you know, try it out. And he said to her, let's start over.
Did he feel a sense of responsibility? You say that he was the oldest son, so he was already dealing with a lot of responsibility for his family. Do you think he felt responsibility for her because he brought her over to make it work?
Paul felt a huge amount of responsibility for Millie after she arrived. He would never turn his back on her. He's a man of great integrity. They both are people of great integrity, and there was no way he was just going to be like, oh, I'm not so sure if this is going to work out. He stuck by her, and I think he deeply loved her and still does, and they've figured out a way to make that marriage happen.
And so this is, they're both in their mid-20s at this point?
They were in their mid-20s at this point, and Paul was very involved in working. You know, as soon as he arrived, he didn't speak the language, so he had a friend who got him a job in a factory. He started working. He was going to English classes. He started going to night school. And he had this whole American life by the time that she showed up. Like, she'd been in Saigon the whole time, trying different ways of getting out, almost died a few times, escaping. There's lots of stories about that moment of her life. And she was also pining away for him and very worried that she might never see him again. And what's my life going to be like if I'm stuck here and he's there? And they had these kind of two parallel existences with not that much communication. So once they got together and he had had his American life and she'd been in Saigon, they also were in very different places when they reconnected. Mm. And so I was really impressed by the fact that they were able to stick it out and make it work. But it wasn't a time of romance. It was a time of landing in America and reinventing yourself and rebuilding your life. And that's very difficult thing to do, as we all know.
Yeah.
That's a very, very hard thing to do. So there wasn't time for the extras. There wasn't time to go dancing. There wasn't time to like go have fun. And I think that that's really the primary reason that they're doing this now. I think that's the real reason that, you know, in their early 60s, 40 years later, they saw this opportunity to do something that they really loved that they didn't get to do when they were young, and that was dancing. And they decided to pursue it with this zeal and this passion that is so much informed by the past.
Well, there's something so intimate, so passionate about this type of dance, the cha-cha, and ballroom dancing in general. It's not like dancing rock and roll or whatever, or any modern dancing. It's very, there's a symbiosis there that really probably, you know, is designed to mimic the most intimate moments between two people.
I mean, ballroom dancing is an incredibly, it's like an idealized movement of romance, I guess is one way to think about it. And it's beautiful, and there's many different ways that, you know, it can be performed. Paul and Millie also waltz, and they do Viennese foxtrot, and they do all the Latin dances. Cha-cha is one of them. The dance that appears in the final scene in the film is actually a rumba, which can be performed more slowly. And that was really appealing to me as a visual way of articulating this story, is that you see all these elements of their story visually represented in the dance. You see the separation, you see the reunion, you see the love, you see the longing, and you see this passion. And I really wanted to make sure that they had ample time to be able to express that in the film. So I didn't want to just tell their story. I wanted to make sure that there's enough time to really see that movement expressed. And also show how hard it is to be able to do that. So I showed classes and I showed rehearsal, so you can see the labor that goes into making it look as beautiful as it does when it's finally performed.
And do they win when they compete?
Sometimes they do. Millie's actually done really well, especially, to be honest, Paul has more nerves during these competitions, but Millie's kind of, she's got the game, and she really, like, she's very calm under pressure, and she does quite well. They perform with their teachers. They study with two teachers who are also immigrants. Elena is from Belarus, and Max is from the Ukraine. They're a married couple who perform together. They're amazing performers. At one point, they were 14th in the world, and they perform professionally and teach professionally, and They're very, very dedicated to all their students at Lilai, and they love working with Paul and Millie because Paul and Millie are so serious. And they do something called Pro-Am competition. You kind of see that on Dancing with the Stars, where the professional dances with the amateur.
Yeah.
And when that happens, you just like raise the level of the dancing so much than if you're two amateurs dancing.
Right.
So they do, they mostly compete with their teachers, but they're starting to compete together as a couple in the senior division. And that'll be something which I'll show a little bit of in the feature length film.
Well, it is a really lovely movie, and it's really moving. And congratulations on the nomination.
Thank you so much.
That's Laura Nix, director of the documentary short Walk, Run, Cha-Cha. It's streaming at thenewyorktimes.com right now, and it's nominated for an Academy Award. Laura, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, the drag star Trixie Mattel is here. She's also a singer. She'll perform. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Maybe you've seen Trixie Mattel on RuPaul's Drag Race.
The champion of All Stars 3 is Trixie Mattel. You're a champion.
You're a winner, baby. That's Trixie being crowned the winner of RuPaul's Drag Race All Stars Season 3. She's the queen that looks kind of like Dolly Parton, turned up to an 11. But Trixie Mattel is also a comedian. She's a television personality and singer. And she has a new album coming out this Friday. It's called Barbara. And here's a little bit of it.
Jesse, Jesse, take my hand. You can meet me in zombie land. You know, inside every clam's a pearl. I could be Jesse's girl.
Well, as you can hear, Trixie Mattel is with me now in the studio.
That's a good song.
Singing along, snapping along, in full drag, by the way.
Yeah, you are too. No one said anything. Yeah. She's in a yellow gown. She's wearing like this flame red updo with like finger waves on flat on the face.
You know, people would believe you.
Yeah, totally.
How would they know?
That's a great thing about going to do radio and drag. You don't have to really be in drag. You can just say you are.
Exactly.
But I really am today.
You really are. I am attesting to that. You are in a 60s kind of what? Like,
well, I'm very into
flowers.
Yeah, it's like a floral print. I'm very into like head to toe pattern. Because it's a little fashionable, but it's also a little like, okay, no one would really wear that. So I like that line of like, you know, is it clown clothes? Is it fashion? It's like that middle part.
It's like, I'm actually doing the same thing wearing a jumpsuit.
Yeah.
So similar.
It's a strong look. And I collect a lot of dolls. A lot of my dolls have these head to toe fabric looks, and it's so weird and, you know, striking.
It makes it easier for, you know, when you get ready.
Yeah. It makes it pretty idiot proof. It makes it very like matchy matchy chic, where it's like, it's meant to go together.
And you have white platforms on.
White platforms,
how many inches?
I'd
say that's a good six.
Six if you measure it from the base.
Okay. So, yeah, you're a striking figure.
Yeah. Well, height is very powerful. Something. I mean, half the magic of drag is being tall, and people really believe you.
So when you're not in drag, how tall are you?
I'm just under 6 feet, just about six feet.
Oh, so you're tall anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I like being
tall. And
you're
wearing a couple of wigs.
Yeah, a few
wigs.
So that
adds the height.
Yeah, a few wigs.
Got your beehive.
Yes.
Happening.
The producer of the record, Nick, is in there, and he's never even seen me in drag until today. And he was like,
what?
You're tall.
In person?
Yeah.
You mean,
he never seen me in person in drag. Because I didn't do the record. You know, spoiler alert, I was not in drag singing the record.
I guess you don't have to be in drag to sing on a record either.
No, you
the
really
bat
don't.
And the radio.
You can lie. I need to become the world's most famous like old-fashioned radio show drag queen. I've never actually dressed up.
Yeah.
Because
exactly.
The dressing up thing is...
It's a lot.
It's a
lot. I appreciate the effort that you took to do
Thanks.
This.
Thank
I really
you.
Do. So tell me about the album, because your last two records, Two Birds and One Stone, they were more folksy, singer-songwritery, country, that kind of music, roots music.
Sure.
Not a poppy, up, disco-y kind of sound. So,
well, I grew up listening to like country music at home, folk music. I grew up, you know, living with my grandparents. And so Two Birds and One Stone was definitely like a reflection of that. And, you know, Two Birds at the time, I broke up with a guy from Kentucky. So there was definitely a huge influence of that, too.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very bourbon-soaked, you know, cry yourself to sleep time of my life. But on Barbara, I'm a lot. It's a very upbeat record. You know, it's very California-inspired. It's very perpetual summer.
Because you live here now.
Yeah, I've lived here for like 4 years. And so like this sort of like all-year summer makes every day meaningful and meaningless at the same time, you know. And that's kind of what it's about. And Barbara, the name of the record was because, you know, if I grew up on country, but then, of course, I learned to play guitar to, like, power pop because, like, Blink-182, Avril Lavigne, I'm 30. So, like, mm-hmm. that was my high school experience was, like, that kind of music. Mm-hmm. So that's what I learned really songwriting on, was like imitating those kind of artists when I was young. So this record kind of feels like a natural progression to me, because that's the kind of music I still listen to a lot. You know,
you still listen to the music from your youth.
Totally. And I had like a...
I guess we all do.
We all do, right?
Do we just stop evolving when we get older?
You actually do. I think I read something that people kind of generally stop listening to new music at a certain point.
Yeah.
And it's fine.
And it's probably
I don't think I'm missing much. I really don't. I really don't.
That's why
I don't watch award shows either. I'm
old
like,
people
who
say.
Are these people? Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I guess with these records, I feel very fortunate because at the time after my last records, I had sort of like a second wind of like pop rock music. Mm-hmm. And I kind of deep dived back into some of my favorite records by like the Go-Go's and the Donnas and the B-52s.
Well, that's way before your time.
The Go-Go's? Yeah, but I love them.
And the B-52s.
Yeah, but I love them.
You're taking some style cues from them.
Totally.
Right?
I love the B-52s. I mean, they were basically doing drag without saying they were in drag.
Right.
Wigs. And I remember hearing interviews with them where they said they, as a band, would go to thrift stores and they would all fight over like the same dress, even though only two of them were women, you know. And I like that kind of attitude.
Yeah. Plus, their look is your look, right?
Yeah,
it's
totally.
Kind of up. Beehive 60s.
Yes. And then I also collect Barbies from about 65 to 73. So that's kind of my sweet spot. So that's where a lot of my look influences come from.
Mm-hmm. Why is that time period your look?
I think to me, it's just the epitome of sort of like the fashion is just a jokier.
Yeah.
Like crazier prints. And it's also right when the body became more like, hide your boobs and your hips. Try to look like you have nothing. Everything is like a shift dress and A-line. Everything's meant to be like, look like
well,
a little.
You're not hiding yours. You're very curvy.
Well, this is nothing compared to, you know, like, there's like on the Malibu, some of the artwork from Malibu and from Barbara, I'm in like a tight little corset with huge hips. And this is like less curvy. This is my subtle look.
This is your day look?
Yeah, this is my day look. But, I mean, we live in Los Angeles. I mean, I don't have more makeup or shaper on than anybody who's, like, a famous musician.
You have a lot
musician.
Of contour. That's...
Yeah, it's a heavy hand, but yeah. I also
am
a man, so I have to kind of, like, put in the extra, you know. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, normal celebrities have on, like, double-stack lashes and fake hair and...
It's true.
A corset. It's like, where do we draw the line? I mean, it's all just fake hair and makeup and perfume, and it really all doesn't mean anything. I think drag queens, the reason they're so popular is because we're a constant reminder that it's like, it's all dress up. You're all just putting clothes on.
Okay. You grew up in Milwaukee.
So I grew up in the deep, deep country, and then I went to college in Milwaukee.
And so deep, deep country meant what? Town
like
of how many?
Super far northeast Wisconsin, like dead end dirt road, no other kids for miles.
Wow.
Yeah. Like the first person to get on the school bus in the morning.
And so when did you get into drag?
Right away. No. when I went to college, I was in a production of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Uh-huh. And there was somebody who was sick. And so I had to jump into like a cross-dressing role. And it just sort of stuck. Like the name Trixie was the name of the character. That's part of where that even came from. I didn't even get the pleasure of picking a drag name. It was sort of thrust upon me.
And you didn't say no? You didn't change it? You thought, this is who I am. I'm Trixie Mattel.
Yeah, and it was sort of fateful because I had a really bad relationship with my stepdad, and he used to call me a Trixie whenever I was being too emotional or too feminine growing up.
What's a Trixie?
It was like saying, you're a fag or something. Uh-huh. You know, like you're a girly boy. And so that word used to really bum me out, and then now it's, you know, it's a brand and a lifestyle.
So when
I took back the night.
You took it back. So you did that on purpose. You were like, I'm going to take this back because this was so difficult for me. And
yeah.
I don't want this to be difficult anymore.
Yes. And I grew up really poor. And Trixie, I remember also looking it up on Urban Dictionary. And Trixie was a slang for like a rich white girl whose parents buy her everything. And it was like another layer of like, oh, I'm into that too. So it was like the stepdad thing, the Rocky Horror thing, and this. It's sort of like Barbara. Barbara was Barbie's real name. Before she moved to California, right?
Yeah.
It also, the real etymology of it, it means strange woman.
Does it?
Yeah, and 12 years into doing drag, I'm a very strange woman. So that was sort of, there's a few reasons why that name for this record made sense.
But less stranger now, because drag is so practically mainstream.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. I mean, it's sort of like how straight people gentrify neighborhoods. You know, they wait for gay people to move in and make it classy, and then they move in.
Yeah.
Same thing happens with drag. Like, drag was always there, it just wasn't on television. So being on television obviously has made people a lot more aware of it. Because it's also, I think people are so afraid of sex that they think if there's cross-dressing, it has to be about sex. And so when you watch it on television, you're like, oh, never mind. It's just basically Halloween every day.
Right.
You know, it's Halloween meets stand-up, meets dancing, meets, it's pretty harmless.
It's not scary. I think people were scared of drag queens.
Totally. It's
sweet. Because, well, A, there's the height. For one.
The height. My eye makeup, I mean, don't I look like one of those predatory moths?
A little
bit. With
the
big eyes on their wings, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it's really about sex because people are afraid of, I think people are so afraid of homosexuality that they're afraid cross-dressing means sex, which means tricking men into, like, it's all related to people's.
Well, why do so many straight guys dress up as women on Halloween or for parties or things like that, do you
think? It's a form of misogyny. Think about it. Their funny joke is that they might be anything like a woman. Mm. It's kind of dark. Do you also go as Asian for Halloween? Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know if dressing as a... But you know what, though? If it makes you feel good, if you're doing it for the right reasons, I guess the intention is the difference.
Yeah, because you wouldn't say that you're doing that.
If somebody to me was like, for Halloween, I'm going to wear a dress. Isn't that funny? I'd be like, yeah, that's so funny.
What if people said, I want to dress up as Trixie Mattel for Halloween?
They sure do. They really do. And on the tours... The first few rows, there'll be three or four or five people dressed as Trixie. And it's so weird to be performing and, like, see yourself sitting over there.
Do they get it right?
They try. I mean, it's a lot of technique. It's a lot of know-how that the average person shouldn't have. You know, I hope they invested their time and their education into something more usable.
Did you make it all up or did you also get tips?
No, I made it all up. I mean, I was doing drag for a few years before I turned 21. So, like, by the time I hit the clubs... I kind of have my own system in place, which is why I really look not like other drag queens. I think I just followed my own thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You're definitely not going for verisimilitude.
No, not at all. I mean, I never wanted to look like a woman as much as I wanted to look like a toy, like a plaything. You pull a string on the back, it talks. And then I figured out early on that I have this dark sense of humor and this thing about, like, if it looks like a kid's toy, but... The comedy is sort of like more the anxieties of adulthood. That's a good match.
Yeah.
And anybody, that's the other great thing about drag is the message is sort of that anybody can be beautiful. It's really just creativity and money.
You're going to play a song, right?
Yeah, we would love to.
I'd love you to play one.
Can we go now?
Yeah, play okay. Now. What's it called?
It's called Malibu. It's from my new record, Barbara. Okay. I wrote it about Malibu, someplace I've never been. If the song is about...
Wait, why have you never been to Malibu if you live here?
I got stuff going on. I got places to go. I got Postmates, you know?
Okay, this is Malibu by Trixie Mattel featuring guitarist Nick Goldston.
Been around for a long time now, I guess. Came around for a one-night thing and I never left. Got a key to your old front door. You can keep me in the bedside drawer. And when you want, you can slide me out again. Take your time. Everybody says so. You'll be fine when you learn to move slow. How did I lose you at the intro? Take me, I wanna go.
That's Trixie Mattel and Nick Goldston on guitar and backup vocals. Nick also produced the record. It's called Barbara, and it's out February 7th.
Never been with a type like you before. Chilled out, top down, just what I've been looking for.
And you can see a video of Trixie Mattel playing this song in our studio. It's up on our Instagram at KCRW Press Play. And that's it for us. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.
Take your time. Everybody says so. You'll be fine when you learn to move slow. How did I lose you at the intro? Take me. I want to go now. Go to me and